Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present David Kotz, professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts, who assesses the possible consequences of Russia's deployment of troops to the Crimean region of Ukraine, the U.S.-European response, and strategies for reducing tensions. Author and filmmaker Alice Rothschild, who discusses her 2013 film documentary, Voices Across the Divide, which explores the historical roots of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And professor of journalism and media activist Jeff Cohen, who discusses public television's conflict of interest when it accepted a $3.5 million donation from an anti-pension billionaire to underwrite a new series examining pension issues. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The Jordan Valley in the occupied West Bank is a fertile area for growing medjool dates, as well as harvesting grapes, peppers, and herbs. For years, these food exports were destined for the European Union, Israel's top trading partner. However, for growing numbers of European customers, food grown on Israeli-occupied Palestinian land has a bitter taste. In 2013, farmers in the Jordan Valley lost $29 million in exports to Europe as they had to rely on less lucrative markets to sell produce. The growing European boycott of Israeli goods is starting to inflict economic pain in Israel as banks, pension funds, and lawmakers are putting pressure on the Israeli government over their opposition to Jewish settlements in the occupied territories. The boycott pressure comes as U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is prodding Israelis and Palestinians to seriously engage in peace talks. A collapse of the current negotiations could put new pressure on Israel. In the days after Uganda imposed a harsh new anti-gay law, including life sentences for individuals convicted of engaging in homosexual acts, the World Bank postponed a $90 million loan to the African nation's health sector. Countries including the Netherlands, Norway, and Sweden have similarly redirected funds away from the government to NGOs. The much-debated Uganda law signed by President Yoweri Museveni on February 24th was met with disapproval from the United States, European nations, and other donor countries. Yet the threats to cut off Western aid has whipped up nationalist fervor to support the punitive anti-gay measure first proposed in 2009 at the urging of American-based evangelical Christians. In 2013, HIV incidence in Uganda rose to 2.3 million, an increase of over 500,000 cases from 2008. AIDS activists say the rise of new HIV cases is the result of scarce resources and Uganda's reliance on simplistic prevention strategies. Enrique Restoy, a senior advisor to the International HIV/AIDS Alliance, predicted, "In Uganda, there will be less and less people who are openly gay. There will be less and less people who will disclose their status to female partners, and therefore, it will be much more difficult to control the transmission of HIV." A proposed new mining project in northern Wisconsin has triggered a resource war between corporate mining interests, native peoples, and environmentalists. Growing demand for steel and other resources in China and India have put the Pinoki Mountains near the Bald River Reservation on the development block. The area is near a critical watershed for Lake Superior and wild rice wetlands valued by the Lake Superior Chippewa tribe. 3 years ago, Gogebic Taconite, or GTAC, a company owned by Florida-based Klein Resource and Development Corporation, started laying claim to 300 million tons of taconite, a low-grade iron ore used for making steel. The ultimate goal, backed by Wisconsin's Republican Governor Scott Walker, is to build a $1.5 billion open-pit taconite mine, 4 miles long and 1,000 feet deep, making it the largest open-pit mine of its kind in the world. Now, a coalition of native tribes and local businesses from three states bordering Lake Superior is requesting that the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency develop an ecosystem-wide study on the impact of mining, measuring how waste rock or tailings could pollute surface and groundwater, endangering local species and the destruction of wetlands. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Liz Becker.
The celebrations of pro-European parties and activists reflecting on their successful ouster of Ukraine's elected president, Viktor Yanukovych, were cut short when it was reported that Russian troops had been deployed to the nation's Crimean Peninsula on February 28th. An unknown number of soldiers said to be Russian, wearing uniforms without insignia, surrounded Ukrainian military bases in the Crimean parliament. Simultaneously, pro-Russian Ukrainian groups organized protests in the country's majority ethnic Russian cities in the east and south, expressing opposition to the de facto government that took power in Kiev after 3 months of an often bloody occupation that cost more than 85 lives. While the Obama administration and its European Union allies threaten Russia with economic sanctions and a boycott of the upcoming Group of Eight economic summit in Sochi this summer, President Putin told Russian media in Moscow on March 4th that the soldiers in Crimea are not Russian, calling them local forces of self-defense. He branded the overthrow of Ukraine's government as an unconstitutional coup and said he hopes that Russia won't need to use force to protect the people of predominantly Russian-speaking eastern Ukraine. Earlier, the Kremlin announced that tens of thousands of Russian troops that had been participating in military exercises near Ukraine's border had been ordered back to their bases. At the same time, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry, meeting with officials in Kiev, announced $1 billion in American loan guarantees to assist the interim Ukrainian government. Your reporter spoke with David Kotz, professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, who assesses the possible consequences of Russia's intervention in Crimea, the U.S.-European response, and strategies for reducing tensions.
The Russian reaction was entirely predictable. I think you have to ask, who made a mistake that led to this disastrous situation? And I'm afraid that has to be laid at the doorstep of the United States and the European Union, both of which encouraged what developed into an armed uprising against the elected president of Ukraine, despite the fact that the leadership of that uprising on the ground consisted of extreme nationalists who were very hostile to Russia and to Russians. Some of them are descended from a group that, during World War II, during the Nazi occupation of the Soviet Union, worked with the Nazi occupiers. One of the first acts of this new parliament after the uprising in Ukraine was to end the official status of the Russian language, which is one of the two official languages of Ukraine, or had been. So once things arrived at that pass, and Russia was now facing a Ukraine that was being pulled from its position, having relations both with the West and Russia, toward being completely taken into the Western alliance, I think it was inevitable that Russia was going to act. I don't think it was some master scheme on the part of Putin. I think it was an inevitable result of having Ukraine pulled in that direction by the West. You know, the EU agreement that Yanukovych had considered signing but then did not sign at the last minute had two key features. One is it included harsh austerity measures that would have been very harmful for the Ukrainian people, but it also had a provision that stated that Ukraine would henceforth follow NATO in military policy. So this meant the major former Soviet state right on the border of Russia was going to be drawn into NATO. It was inevitable that Russia was going to react since it sees NATO as an anti-Russian military force and didn't want to see it extend right to its border in a large state that had always been part of or friendly to Russia.
Professor, what do you think Vladimir Putin's objectives are in sending troops to the Ukraine are? Is it annexation or pressure to extract concessions from the new Ukrainian government in Kiev?
Nobody is sure. One possibility is that Putin has stated that he favors keeping Ukraine independent and its present borders. Now, maybe he's changed his mind, but one possibility is that by taking control of Crimea, which is overwhelmingly ethnic Russian, it may be that he is trying to press the new government in Kiev to negotiate and to break its ties with the extreme right-wing nationalists. The new government is not made up of these right-wing nationalists, but they played a leading role in the armed uprising, and they have a lot of soft influence. I assume that's why the parliament passed this very harmful anti-Russian language law. So perhaps Putin thinks once the new leaders realize that their actions are threatening the survival of the Ukraine state, that they will think twice and make it clear that they will respect the rights of ethnic Russians in eastern Ukraine and in Crimea. That's one possibility.
Professor Kotz, when you look at the U.S. and European response to the Russian troops being deployed in Crimea, what do you make of the threats of economic sanctions against Russia, including a boycott of the G8 summit in Sochi this summer, and other things that are being talked about, such as deploying anti-missile systems to Poland and Romania earlier than had previously been agreed to? A lot of saber-rattling is going on right now. Is that productive?
I think it's totally unproductive. I don't know if anyone thinks it will have any impact on what Russia does in this situation. The fate of Ukraine is of central importance to Russian policymakers, and it'd be hard to believe that the threat, kind of threats being made or that might plausibly be made and carried out, would change their actions in this. It's embarrassing the way the media have been treating this as a match between two individuals, you know, who will blink first, Obama and Putin. It's being treated as this kind of manhood contest. I think the right policy would be for the Obama administration to open negotiations with Russia to try to arrive at a compromise in which the Ukrainian government would clearly recognize the rights of all the people of Ukraine. I think that, you know, with some kind of guarantees for the rights of ethnic Russians as well as ethnic Ukrainians. I think that's the way to solve the problem, not saber rattling when everyone knows there, you know, no saber is going to be drawn.
That was David Kotz, professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts Amherst and co-author of the book Russia's Path from Gorbachev to Putin, The Demise of the Soviet System and the New Russia. For more perspectives on the crisis in Ukraine, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Alice Rothschild is an obstetrician from the Boston area who was raised in a Jewish household. Growing up, she was a Zionist who supported the State of Israel. When she traveled to Israel with her family, she remembers never having seen the Palestinians who lived there. In 1997, Rothschild began trying to understand the Palestinian-Israeli conflict and has since organized many delegations to the West Bank, Gaza, and Israel with a strong contingent of medical professionals. In 2007, she published a book titled Broken Promises, Broken Dreams, which examines the roots of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. In her 2013 documentary film called Voices Across the Divide, she features interviews with Palestinians about the conflict, some of whom recount their personal memories of the turbulent time in history when, during the birth of Israel in 1948, more than 700,000 Palestinians were driven from their land and homes. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Rothschild after a screening of her film at the Yale University Law School in late February. Here she describes the many different divides in the region and her understanding of the Palestinian organized boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement.
The way I came to making this film started with writing a book, which actually had Jewish Israeli voices and Palestinian voices. And when I was book touring, the Palestinians in the audience, wherever I was speaking, would interrupt me to tell me their stories. And so I really became aware that there was this huge wealth of family stories out there that I did not know. And there was a whole history that I didn't know. So I came to making this film as an attempt to add to the historical record and to bring to fore the history that we don't hear. And since the Jewish version of history, the Zionist version of history, the Israeli Jewish version of history is the predominant one, it seemed to me that it was very appropriate for me to search out Palestinian voices and to hear what happened to them from their point of view.
Just explain the divide as you understand it.
Well, I don't think there's only one divide. As I was growing up, there was this unbridgeable gap between the Jews and the Arab terrorists, basically. And so that was one big divide. And then I began to learn about the divisions in our understanding of history and our understanding of justice and our understanding of humanity. So that's another divide. And the more I look at this conflict, the more divides I see. So the name Voices Across the Divide was referring to me as a Jewish woman going across whatever divides there are that separate me from my Palestinian cousins and trying to figure out what their lives are about.
We're in a situation now where the relatively new Secretary of State has really made achieving peace in the Middle East, I guess, priority number one. The idea of a two-state solution, do you think that that is still even possible?
Well, I think the idea of a two-state solution, which came out of the Oslo Accords, may possibly have been possible at that point, although there's a lot of question about what kind of states they would be. When I'm in the region now and I look at the massive settlement growth, the bypass roads that only people with Israeli license plates can go on, the fact that the Jordan Valley is now a military zone and Palestinians are not allowed to live there except around Jericho. When I look at what some people call the Bantustanization or the Cantonization of the West Bank, I don't see a viable state. And then if you look at the separation wall, 85% of it is within the West Bank. It's very hard for me to imagine what kind of state they're thinking about. So, you know, I'm sure that there are many people that are for the two-state solution, but they don't ask what kind of state. And if Palestinians don't have a state that is contiguous with itself, that doesn't have borders with other countries, if they don't have some control over their water and their air and all the things that a state has to have, it's not going to be viable. At this point in history, I think that the behavior of the Israeli government has removed the chance of a two-state solution. And in fact, if you look at Netanyahu's cohorts and his party, they're not in favor of a two-state solution. And there are plenty of people in his camp that believe in a greater Israel, and I think that's what they've created. So for me, as a Jewish activist, I see the struggles ahead as more one a struggle against apartheid rather than a struggle for a two-state solution. And I see that struggle has to do with human rights for all in the region and not the privileging of Jewish rights over Palestinian rights.
Another thing that I think is one of the hot issues in the region is the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, which is a Palestinian civil society movement that started in 2005 and is really, as you said in your talk tonight, picking up steam. Talk about your view of the BDS campaign and especially the academic and cultural boycott, because I think there's really a lot of misunderstanding of what it is.
So first of all, I see Palestinian civil society engaged in a liberation struggle. And I feel that this is a nonviolent struggle and that we as fellow activists who are interested in human rights need to respect the call. It is clear to me that the cultural and academic boycotts are the most complicated. They involve issues of freedom of speech and, you know, hearing the other and all those kind of things. And it is very clear to me also that there will be problems with people having their voices heard if there is a real cultural and academic boycott. On the other hand, it's not that you can't invite an Israeli professor to your university in the United States. That's completely allowed. What's not allowed is to set up, for instance, like the joint program between Cornell and the Technion, where the institutions on an institutional level are having a joint program. And the reason for that is to call attention to the fact that so many Israeli universities either have huge military contracts, are involved in developing security apparatus, have campuses on the West Bank, have campuses on destroyed Palestinian villages. I mean, it's calling attention to the complicity of universities in the occupation. The other thing that the academic boycott is calling attention to is the fact that Palestinian universities are under occupation, that professors can't get permits, that American professors can't get permits to go work in a Palestinian university. I mean, there's a huge amount of repression and lack of being heard going on in Palestinian academic settings that we're completely oblivious to. I think it's really something we need to take seriously.
That was Alice Rothschild discussing her documentary film about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict titled Voices Across the Divide. For more information about the film and related issues, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In an investigative piece titled The Wolf of Sesame Street, revealing the secret corruption inside PBS's news division, published on the news website Pando Daily, journalist David Sirota wrote about a public broadcasting service news series titled The Pension Peril, which advocated cuts to public employee pension benefits. The Pension Peril series, scheduled to be broadcast by PBS stations across the country over the course of 2 years, Sirota reveals, was secretly funded by former Enron company trader and billionaire John Arnold. Arnold, who had donated $3.5 million to PBS for the production of the Pension Peril series, is a passionate and longtime critic of public employee pensions. As Sirota reports, through his foundation, Arnold has made large contributions to politicians, political action committees, and think tanks to advance his campaign to slash public employee retirement benefits. Disturbingly, the PBS series presented views critical of pension funds very similar to that of its funder, without revealing to the audience the source of its financial support. However, just 2 days after Sirota's investigative piece was published on February 12th, an embarrassed PBS management announced it would return the $3.5 million provided by John Arnold. Your reporter spoke with Jeff Cohen, founder of the media watch group Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, who now serves as the founding director of the Park Center for Independent Media at Ithaca College. Here he discusses the obvious conflicts of interest and ethical violations that occur when media outlets allow their funders to influence the content and political spin of their journalism.
The funder of this, to the tune for $3.5 million, former Enron trader, hedge fund manager named John Arnold. John Arnold has gone all over the country funding political efforts, ballot initiatives, think tanks, advocacy groups that push toward the cutting of public workers' pensions. He's a monomaniac about it. Everyone in the world knows it. The great journalist Matt Taibbi referred to this guy, John Arnold, as the next generation's Koch brothers. You know, there are many ways that you could balance state budgets. You could cut corporate subsidies. You could bring down the prison industrial complex. You could raise taxes on the wealthy. But John Arnold and others have the ability to twist the debate. So the only idea that gets prominence in how to balance state budgets is cut the public workers' pensions. So John Arnold is famous for underwriting a whole social movement around that cause. And then public TV starts running a series of news segments called The Pension Peril, and John Arnold has funded it for $3.5 million. The money was ultimately returned, and the series has been put on hiatus because David Sirota exposed it. And it became a controversy. But I would argue that the funding of public affairs news, public affairs programs, documentaries, 8-part, 1-hour series for years, for 15 years or so on public television, that corporations have underwritten programming that they had no business underwriting, and the results in the programming showed unmistakable corporate bias because the corporations paid for the programming.
Jeff, in theory, is there not supposed to be a firewall between the fundraising arm of a nonprofit media outlet like PBS and the news producers and news directors who make decisions about content?
There's no doubt that public TV has rules, but they've never been abided by. I mean, the rules say not only should an interested funder not be allowed to fund programming, but someone who has the perception of interest. You know, it's not just about the reality of bias. It's even they're supposed to protect at public television against bad optics. But the reality is there's no longer any optics at all at public TV because the corporations have been underwriting the programming for so many years, you know, no one even sees it anymore. That's the problem. People are blind to it. I could give you example after example. Last year, Nova had a show called The Rise of Drones. One of the funders was Lockheed Martin, a major drone manufacturer. Another show about the food industry. Big funder, Dow Chemical, you know, a GMO corporate food company. About 10 years ago, there was this multi-part series called Commanding Heights on public television, extolling, you know, multinational capitalism. It was so biased that the Wall Street Journal was just raving about how great it was with an article headlined, PBS likes capitalism more than the commercial networks do. Who funded that? BP, Federal Express, and Enron, until Enron was exposed as a graft operation and the Enron money was returned, but not the money to all the other corporations. You can go on and on and on and on, and it's part of the reason that public television in this country is so timid, is so bland, and will not take on the most powerful forces in our society, who just happen to be large corporations that are their underwriters.
Given the fact that public broadcasting in this country is taxpayer funded, is there a way that we as citizens could put pressure on PBS or Congress to put back in place a firewall between these corporate funders and the content of what comes across taxpayer broadcasts?
Yeah, I think it's less a congressional issue. People who donate to PBS should confront their local PBS stations and say, how come we don't have a labor show every week? How come we don't have an environmental show every week? You know, the money that I donate to you, I want some of it to go to local programming. And I want that programming to be different than the corporate type programming that's coming out of PBS in Washington and New York. And if you don't offer some of that programming, I'm not going to fund you.
That was Jeff Cohen, founding director of the Park Center for Independent Media and associate professor of journalism at Ithaca College. He's author of 5 books, including Cable News Confidential, My Misadventures in Corporate Media. Find links to David Sirota's investigative piece on PBS and related articles on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Liz Becker, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.